Session number 794.
Fred Copeman, reel 7.
What kind of tank did you get?
Well, it's the biggest bloody tank I've ever seen. It's nothing like the modern ones, but to me it was a colossal thing. It was a beautiful dark green. Brand new. Quite by luck we got it, you know. We'd got these crowd out, and I think about 5 of them came out of the tower. And I said to Jen, you go on, you take them down. Just as we got outside the door, and I saw this tank. And it was like a Sunday morning parade. They weren't taking any part in the battle. They were hidden behind a little house, but only about 50 yards from a tower. And they weren't interested in us. They didn't seem to know what we were doing. I expect they assumed, you know, we were one of them kind of business. Anyway, I said, Ginger, you take these bloody 5 down, and I'm going to get this. Give me a couple of hand grenades. Gave me a couple of hand grenades. We went by the house, and I went round it. The tank was at the back, and I went round the other side. You wore rope-soled shoes. I'd made up my mind what I was going to do, because I'd always come to the conclusion they weren't in this bloody water, but didn't know what was going to hit them. And by now, I'd got so used to tanks that they didn't worry us at all. Any tanks that attacked us on the Karama front, they didn't get anywhere, you know, because our front, all this Yankus business had produced sapping trenches and holes that one man could get in, you know, with little Molotov Coca-Cola bottles, that's all they were, with half filled with petrol and a little fuse in them, which you lit by hand, by luck. If you could get the damn thing lit without it blowing up and get rid of it, you were lucky. But they were always useful. So we were no longer frightened of tanks. And I was determined to have a prize. Anyway, I got round this damn building, and there was a bloke nattering. A bloke standing up in the turret talking to somebody inside, and he had his back to me, so I just hopped on the bloody back quietly and put my hand on his bloody head, kept his head down, and just poked a bloody hand grenade between his legs and waited. And up it went. And his body went up. Up to the end of that. There was dead silence inside, and that's it.
What nationality were they?
German. Oh, yes, they were Germans. All very smart fellows. But then he dropped the clanger. We got his tank. Cut the bloody thing down. Then I think it was number one company, the end one, too far away, didn't realise that we'd captured it, opened up on us. We got in this bloody tank. Job was to see which buttons did what, you know. First button I bloody well pressed a hooter went. I couldn't switch the bloody thing off. And there was me, all alone in this bloody great thing. Finally I got it going. And I came waddling down the bloody road. Well, Ginger told them, Fred's going after a tank, and everybody now, because there was no bullets coming from the tower, everybody was happy, weren't they? And this bloody great tank came waddling down the road, everybody cheering, everybody edgel. Finally, we met number 3 company, and all hell let loose. They suddenly decided it was a bloody German tank. And, you know, it wanted belting. And it was me trying to say no, and I couldn't drive with only a little thing in front of me and tell anybody what was going on. So I simply drove off the bloody road and got out of the way and got out. And I didn't half rip one off of that lad, number 3. It was Joe Hinks, of course. Joe was the fellow who brought the machine gun company up to the divisional headquarters later on. Anyway, that was that. We then decided to attack the village. By now we're getting on to evening. And this is where the women and kids came out with a crowd behind them. And they shot Bill Meredith, the commander of number 2 company.
What do you mean? Who shot him?
A crowd came out of the village. It was getting dusk. And the village were on fire anyway. It was still defending itself. We were going to storm it anyhow. And we were on our way. And then a crowd of people came out down the road, women and kids, be about 100 of them. And we greeted them because they were, I said, ceasefire, lad, let these women through. And when they got right in the middle of the battalion, it was now getting a bit dark, all hell let loose, bloody hand grenades were being thrown, there was fascist troops behind them. And they got through, that eased off. And then somebody was calling on the road. A bloke was lying on the road calling, By now, the only light was the flames from the village. And Bill Meredith went over to help him, and it was one of these fascists. And as old Bill leant over him, he shot him, killed him. So, of course, that was pretty awful. Immediately, a runner came and said, Bill Meredith's been killed, etc. I said, well, let the deputy take over, but keep going. We'll come back and bury him when it's all over. And on we went, and then about 5 minutes after, we got very close to the village, another big fella came out waving a revolver. Called him Commandante. Well, that was a bit bloody daft. See, we just had Bill Meredith shot. I wasn't going to have any Commandante malarkey here. I was going to say, here I am kind of business. By luck, he came up, right up to me. I expect he noticed he had the flames behind him, and he could see faces of people others couldn't. A bloke with an officer's uniform would do him. Well, he got within about 5 yards, and I decided I've got to have this fellow. Well, for the first time in the whole span of Civil War, I had a little revolver. It was a tiny little old thing. Mm-hmm. I decided to have him before he had me. When he got right up, he was gabbling in Spanish. I didn't understand any old how, so I poked my little gun out and went, punk, and it hit him here, and nothing happened. He just kind of shook his head.
Right through the head?
Yeah, right in the middle. He didn't fall over. Try it, and another bang, and it took two, and then he fell over. I've always regretted it. I've never forgotten that incident. Something tells me it was wrong, you know, that he was coming out to surrender the village. But a Billy Loon was carrying a damn great revolver in his hand in the dark. Well, anyway, he got killed. We went in. I took his revolver, by the way. First time I had a big gun. Didn't have it for long. Gave it away next morning. I think it was to Joe Hinks. Because I got guilty about shooting the fella, you see. In my own mind, that was. We went in, took the village. The Dimitrov had come in from the right. We were both met, and then there was a scamper to get to the top of the tower to put your flag up, see, the British Battalion flag. We got ours up, and it was taken over. There were a few incidents of blokes dropping hand grenades in basement windows, and which we stopped because there were all women and children there, and got the troops out. And I left it then for the company commander to clean it up. I just sent an order around, look, clean up your own sectors, go right through the village, and when it's cleaned up, settle down. Alan Foote turned up and said, fella, got a nice place for you. So we went in a little house, beautiful little house, went up to a bedroom with a lovely, huge, big four-poster bed with the softest mattress I've ever slept on in my life. When I got down on it, I was like sinking in the snow. And I went to sleep. I got woken up, somebody slung a hand grenade in the door. One of we always had odds and ends hanging around. And there was a guard, always a guard. And I never handled anything like that. It just got handled by Alan Foote. The battalion staff had their own people doing each job. And Alan's job was to look after the defence of battalion headquarters wherever we went, put guards on, get relieved and all that kind of thing, get the passwords passed out and things like that. So I had a good night's sleep. We got up in the morning and I had a look round. This was a lovely place. I think it must have been a priest's house or some high official of the church, because it was so good in a village of that type. Lovely furniture and all beautiful things. So a big silver urn. I lifted it up, it was very heavy. It was full up with big silver coins. I thought, oh, we're in something here. So I passed this over to Hooky Walker and I said, you got some money here, old mate, now use it. I said, old Joe Hinks, now Joe, you're going to stay behind with your company and do all the burying and look after, you know, wounded and things. And we're on our way, the other three companies. So away we went. It was still all this open ground. Brunetti had been taken, it hadn't been defended, been given up without fighting. So Tito's crowd, the Dimitrov, went to our right. We went straight towards Mosquito Hill, which you could see in the distance. It was a big, high ground, rocky, in this rather low, smooth, a bit of a wood down by the river. But before we got to the river, the new American battalion arrived, brand new from the camp, the Washington Battalion, with a big black Negro in charge, but named Wall. I thought, well, this is bright, we've got a bloody darky in charge of a Yankee battalion. I didn't think they had, you know, had any time for him, but he did. University lad he was. Said he'd like to know what to do. He'd been told to be in reserve by Jock Cunning to us, and Jock had said, have a word to Fred. I said, well, all you got to do is stay behind us, about a mile. I said, well, before we get down to this wood you can see in the distance, watch it. The first thing that's going to happen now, we're going to have an air raid. They're going to have us because they've got nothing else to use. So that's what you've got to be prepared for. And if we can get down there without being spotted, we'll be all right. And to be not to be spotted is not to be formal. You mustn't be in lines, just be in spots. It would look like corn, because this is a cornfield we're going up. Miles of it have been cut. And none of your damn, you know, forget the camp business of arrow formations and things like that. Just get there, spread out and look awkward.
Could you use some kind of camouflage?
Yes. Well, we had our own way of doing things. If it was in a road, we got the lads in the main off the road when there was about 50 yards off the road, and leave a few on the road to attract the aircraft. Of course, you can lose a lot of troops, you know, with one aeroplane. These were damn great Caproni bombers, about six of them. Huge black things, low down. You can almost see the eyes of the bloody pilots. So our lads just went into little rings, in bundles, round bundles. This is the type of training we did at Mondeca for anti-aircraft.
But if you all get into a bunch, then the plane can kill you even more easily.
No, they can't. They can't. You'd be surprised. They've got to see you first. See, they have to up in an aeroplane. Of course, you've got to remember, they're moving over ground very fast. They're not going slowly or looking at it. They're going like hell. They've got to see something and decide that's it. So if they happen to choose you, well, that's your very lot. My job is to make them think twice. If they think twice, it's too bloody late to think again, they've gone. This bloody loon was coming over in his lovely arrows, and obviously you could see him, they could see him long before they got to the side. That was a target, so they dropped everything on him. He lost them. Oh, overwhelming majority of his battalion were killed, wiped out. They dropped every bloody thing.
Which battalion was that?
That was Washington, behind us, a mile at the back. Just slightly higher, we were sloping down towards the river. We didn't get a single casualty. When they'd gone over, we just got up and kept going. On other occasions, if we had the cover, we would simply all fire at them, rifles, everything you got, if they were low down. And usually you could do a bit of good. But on this occasion, we were out in the open, it was decided if they were attacked. It's the type of thing we had to talk about. Before we left, we had the company commander say, where we go? Look, there's a map. There's a river at the bottom. We want to get up on that bloody hill by tonight. That's what we're after. And there must be, we've got about 15 miles to go. And this open country, air raids. The idea is to make yourself into wheat sheaves. This is a wheat field. He won't know up there that we're not bloody wheat sheaves as long as we're in that formation. But no bloody squares and things like that. It must be round.
How do you make yourselves into wheat sheaves?
Well, you all get in a ring, close together. 12 or 14, 20 lads together, heads in the middle, and duck in. See, and you kneel down. Well, looking from up top, it's just a circle. And they're all formal circles. And yeah, looking at this, not a human being. The only thing of being up here must be wheat. Show any whites or face or anything. You're all in khaki. You just hide everything you can. The danger was your white shoes on the outside edge. So we tucked them in. You have to practice these things and then let the lads come and look, see what they look like. This is during the time at Mondeca before we came out. This is the type of training you get. Well, they didn't do it and they paid a penalty. We went on from there, crossed the river, met about six blokes in a slit trench who didn't produce much. They just fired a couple of rounds, tried to run, but they didn't get anywhere. And away we went. And then we decided to take the road. There was only one bit of cover. That was, once again, on the sides of the road. There was no other cover. And we carried on up this road, right through, stopped for a break for midday, grub came up and that. There was no opposition, you see, until we reached anti-tank gun range of Mosquito Hill, and then we started to get casualties. Not a lot. We'd lost most, of course, in that damn village. That's where Charlie Goodfellow got killed. Life is an amazing bloody thing. We can make up our minds what to do, but it doesn't work that way. I was discussing that Charlie was going to go home. Harry Pollitt had sent a letter to say that there was a bit of trouble with Charlie at home, and he ought to come home. I said, all right, I'll come home after Renetti. We were just saying, now, Charlie, when we get to the top of the hill, you pack your bag, old Bill Rust will be up with the car and he'll pick you up and you're on your way home. And that'll be that. I'd hardly got it out of my mouth and there was a bloody shell drop just behind us. We were sitting in this trench. There was a road in front of us. We were on the right-hand side of the road and it was up in its shell. And a plump in the bloody lap, a big ball of pink stuff. Like chalk fell in my lap, bit of blood in it. I looked round, Charlie didn't have any head. Bloody head was blown off. He had his boots on, my boots. He was the fourth bloke to have the boots on. And I said to old Joe Hinks, you bury old Charlie with those bloody boots on and don't let anybody else have them. Enough bloody casualties for those, they're Jonas. And on we went. We were getting towards evening when we reached the Mosquito Hill, and it was a big, steep, huge boulders, like a colossal heap of boulders. Hard to get over, they were so big. But there was places round them. And we got up and up and up. Must have got halfway up. We could see everything behind us now. We were looking down on, once again, you could see everything. We could see the Dimitrov battalion were well behind us. They were only just coming across the river. And Campesino's division were well over to the left, about 7 or 8 miles in a valley going through some little village. Got stuck round a burial place, where the Spanish cemeteries and it got thick walls all around them, you know. They put coffins in them. And they were built across a road. A little old road went through it. And looking once, we couldn't get any further. We reached halfway and then all hell let loose. The bloody bullets were coming from up top. And in a rocky place, there's nowhere to hide. They bounce off, you know. You can't get lads to go. They don't know where it's coming from. The bullets are nipping. Actually, they're just bouncing off the rocks. There's some lad up top. Not many were required up there, no more than a company was enough to stop us if they had machine guns, and they did, you see. And then another crowd appeared. I looked through my glasses and another mob appeared to our right on the top. They didn't come down, they just took the top of the hill, and in the bottom was this river. So I tried twice. I said, let's have one more go for the top. Bit of a bloody dream, actually, but it taken us a bloody hour to get halfway up. We weren't going to get the remainder in half a bloody hour. Anyway, we had one more go. We lost a few more lads, and I said, all right, this is it. Now we'll dig in here. If you can call it digging in, there was not much to dig. You had to hide behind rocks or get rocks and build yourself little fortresses, and that's what they did. And there we stuck. I put my headquarters right at the bottom by the river. And sure enough, when I turned up that night, there was the old mattress all laid out and real, you know. You never believe it, how these lads looked after me in that bloody battalion headquarters. And then the problem was how we were going to get grub. Because looking back, all we could see was a long slope of clear ground, a slow slope down the river. And obviously we could see it. People higher up, it was like a map to them. Nothing could move over it. And once 2 days had passed and we hadn't got any grub, and they were getting more and more troops up there and more equipment, searchlights, the lot. We were stuck. We were in a damn dangerous position. Jock got up during the night and said, I don't know what we're going to do, Fred. We've got the anti-tank battery, by the way, and that little heap of rocks you can see, look back on the road, but we've got nothing else. The Lincoln Battalion, he said, they're stuck just this side of the river. That's about 3 miles back. And the Dimitrov are in the same boat, but they haven't even reached the river. At least you haven't got over it. He said, therefore, you'll have to hang on to what you got. He said, there's going to be some tanks come up tomorrow night. He said, nothing will get over here now. But the tanks will come up tomorrow night. Well, the next night, 3 tanks turn up. And Russian tanks, I found, didn't really do much. They just milled around. At least these 3 got over the river. Starting to get up among the rocks, and then all hell let loose. And the next we knew was they didn't move anymore. So we had 3 dead tanks, but not any Russian crews. They got out somehow. There were no bodies in them. So I'm certain they looked after themselves. No, I didn't have much faith in the Russians. The Air Force, those that did fight, and there weren't many. Most of the Air Force, you know, were paid people, what you'd call mercenaries. Get paid so much for each flight, Republican Air Force, in the early days. They finally got a good crowd, but they did a good job at Karama. Didn't see anything of them at all at Brunetti. And then we were up there, what was it, 4 days? And I could see nothing moving, because I could watch it. We're watching the whole battle from up there. We could see the Spaniards. The whole division of them hung up. They hardly got anywhere. And nobody else moved on in our brigade. They just dug in. And then up went a bit of ammunition on the second day. Down in the valley, they stacked it. We could all see loads of transport coming down the river, going back, not coming across the river. So there we were stuck. And then I got an instruction from Jock. We had a bit of an argument with the division when we took the machine gun company up with old Joe Hinks. And when I got back, there was a message to say that we'd got to come out of the line that night, and I had to go back to England. I said, you must be bloody joking. How the hell can a battalion commander go back to England? The lads will think you run away, you go, you can't do that. Oh, that's all been arranged, Fred. They're all back. Jock went yesterday. I said, he never said a bloody word to me about going back. I only talked to him yesterday, going to bring tanks up and bloody thing. He said, oh, he's already gone. George Aiken's gone. He said, they're all gone. You're the last one. Sure enough, we got back that night. It's funny how you couldn't get food up. We tried everything. Whole horde of bloody donkeys and mules, about 40 of them, loaded with soup cans at the top of the hill in the dark, and then belt hell out of them, make them run down the hill, hope they reach the river. The natural thing is they go for water. They never got there. The bloody searchlights opened up, and they all ran away from the lights, of course. They don't like bright. I all went back up the bloody hill. Those who didn't get wiped out. But we finally got some grub through. Anyway, we got out of there without hardly a shot being fired, the whole bloody battalion. We lost a lot of casualties by bloody foolishness, mainly during the 4 days. Sam Wilde was wounded, arguing a bloody point on football or some bloody thing. A bullet went through 3 of them. It killed one good old lad. Little fellow he was. Went right through his head, went through the next bloke's chest, and then went through Sam's thigh. It must have been an anti-tank bullet, you see. Killed 2, and Sam got badly wounded again. That was him back in hospital. And then we got down by the river, settled down for the night. Once again, the bed turned up under a tree. Of course, they had to pick a bloody Spanish holly tree, which every time you move, you've got something stuck in you. The leaves are so prickly. Woke up in the morning to funny noises. Oh, see big shiny things rolling down the hill among the lads laid out, because we were the slope into the river hid us from the hill itself. We were about 5 miles away now anyway. and they were shelling us. They'd spotted where we were, and they knew we were just over there, and they decided to shell it. But none of them went off. Not a single shell went off. They all rolled down the hill into the river. Big 9-inch shell, you know. You see them coming here, even. Well, that went by. Then the bloody flock of sheep disappear. They scatter in this shelling business. The hooky walker went now. I said, "And bugger you about your bloody sheep. I'm not interested in sheep. I've got to get to London." Oh, he said, "You're bloody luck." I said, "Don't worry, I'll be back." Sure enough, old Bill Russ turned up with his car. And we went back to Mondeca, and then we went to Barcelona and back to London.
Why did they pull you out right in the middle like that?
I never knew myself. To this day, I don't know why that was done. There was trouble in the brigade. Things weren't going well, and Brunetti, the fact that the British had been stuck up on that hill on their own, didn't go down well with the British Communist Party. And all kinds of ideas could have come about. People were being blamed for that, especially Jock Cunningham, who'd been in charge of the sector. He'd been in charge of the British, the Washington, the Lincoln, and the Dimitrov battalions. He was now on a brigade staff. And, of course, he'd lost one battalion, the Washington, in that air raid. The other two hadn't got anywhere, and only the British had reached the target, which was Mosquito Hill. So there was a lot of top-level criticism going on. And Harry Pollitt, who was very much determined to look after our lads, he wouldn't let them be pushed around, had obviously decided to call everybody back and let's start again, because we were going out the line anyway. It was going to be some time before they had another action. They had got such a pasty. And anyway, we arrived at King Street, and all the Central Committee were there, and there was George Aitken. I think George was there, I'm not sure. Yes, I think George was there. Jock Cunningham, Wally Tapson, myself, Williams, a commissar, the Welsh fella, Will Painter. Well, that was it. And they started their meeting. I wasn't too much interested and wouldn't know when the hell we were going to get back and get on with it. But they started an attack on Wally, on Jock Cunningham. Really went to town on Jock Cunningham. So I said to Tom Mann and there was another well-known union bloke who was on the Central Committee, Tom Mann and, I forget the bloody name. They were good fellows. I said, "What the hell is going on?" I said, "You can't stand with this." He said, "Fred, you've got to let it go. This is what politics is about. You'll have to swallow it. You'll have time to do your stuff, but they've all got to say the piece."
What were they saying to Jock Cunningham?
The general idea was that he'd become big-headed and the personality building up of himself and all this business, etc., etc. In actual fact, nothing of the kind. Jock was just not that type. He was just a batty fine fellow, and everybody knew it. And therefore they kind of worshipped him. He only had to turn up the front. They all liked it. It was an honour for Jock to come up once he'd left the battalion. And he'd been in number one company, been right through them, very sure born. He was about the best fellow of the lot. But they had decided on a clean-up. That was bloody obvious. I did my piece. I said, "First of all, let's get bloody clear. I'm not standing for this criticism of Jock Cunningham." I said, "If any of these commissars here have anything to say, let them bloody well say it, because they know Cunningham."